Hello listeners, will you allow me a minute to tell you about Past Test? If you haven't used them yet, you should. They are a fantastic online resource with hundreds of questions and answers covering multiple medical exams, including the MRCS, MRCP and medical finals. I've used them lots and found the resource so useful, particularly the past papers for these exams. As a listener to the podcast, you lucky people get 15% off some of these subscriptions. So don't wait around. I mean, do until the end of the episode, but then go and get your access. Links and codes will be in the show notes. Who will a dim bone, dim bone, dim
drive on? Welcome to MRCS on the Move. Bowels, bones, and backseat vibers. I'm your host, Naomi, but this is the podcast where you do the talking.
Okay, hello, and welcome to another episode of MRCS on the Move. It's very good to be back with you. I am quite happy today as I'm in my slightly more of my comfort zone than normal, and we're back discussing a urological topic. So today we are going to discuss the very common presentation of ureteric stones, and I'm happy to welcome on the podcast with me today Mr. Ash Kumar, who is one of my urology consultants here at York. He's a specialist or specializes in ureteric stones and some female urology. So welcome, Mr. Kumar, to the podcast.
Thank you.
Are you looking forward to it?
Yes, absolutely.
You just told me you're a pro at podcasts, is that true?
Never done this before, so see what happens.
Yeah, I'm sure you'll be great. It'll be fine. So, as always, we'll just get stuck in normal setup. So we'll ask you guys a question, give you some time to think about your exam answer, and then Mr. Kumar is going to give us the perfect answer. So yeah, let's crack on. So the first question is, I shall find it. So as we know, ureteric stones are a very common presentation in urology departments, and they're an important differentiation or differential diagnosis for abdominal pain, so very important for any surgical SHO to know about. So let's start by thinking a little bit about the epidemiology of it. So what is the lifetime risk of developing kidney stones, and what is the risk of developing a second stone after you've had one?
Okay, so the lifetime risk of developing a kidney stone does vary by area, and there have been several studies into it, but generally speaking, if you think of 1 in 10 of the population having a kidney stone at some point in their life, then that's probably a fair assessment. The data that's been published has talked anywhere from 1 to 20%, but some of the areas are even higher. Sweden, Canada and America have much higher area prevalence of kidney stone formation, and there has been some data published that some populations have as much as 37%, so it can vary quite a fair bit. Once you've had a kidney stone, unfortunately, we tell patients that they've got another risk of having a kidney stone, and I generally quote 50%, which is a widely accepted sort of lifetime risk of having another kidney stone within their life. There is a recent review article that looked at it and said 26% will have a recurrence in 5 years, and your very high risk stone formers, well, they'll come back every 5 years or so with a kidney stone. And these are the patients who we regard as being sort of frequent flyers.
And you mentioned these different areas that have higher instances. Is there much evidence about why those areas have theories?
There are theories behind it. I think the difficulty is always a population-based study, so it can be very difficult to know whether one particular intervention is going to make a big difference. But certainly people have looked at a whole variety of things as to why kidney stones form, and I'm sure we'll come and talk about that as well. Kidney stones are going to form because of things like diet, lifestyle factors, and certain areas where they perhaps don't have access to the same levels of health prevention. Then these are the sorts of areas that unfortunately are going to have higher prevalences of developing kidney stones, so that's something to bear in mind.
It's a bit multifactorial, probably.
Exactly.
Right, yeah. Okay, so we'll move a little bit on to the pathophysiology. You've sort of just touched on it a little bit there, or alluded to it. What are the different compositions of stones, and which one is the most common?
So there are different types of stones made of different materials, but essentially calcium oxalate generally tends to be the most prevalent of all the types of stones. About 70% of stones, up to about 80% of stones, are some form of calcium oxalate, of which they're further subdivided into monohydrate and dihydrate type stones. You can also have what we call struvite stones, or magnesium, ammonium, phosphate type stones, uric acid, cysteine, and calcium and phosphate as well. So lots of different types of stones, but generally speaking, when you get back a stone analysis from a biochemistry lab, you've got a combination of a few things, so you do have to kind of tailor the report for the patient.
Can you tell us some key characteristics of each of the types of stones?
So the calcium oxalates, particularly the sort of dihydrate versions, very, very tough stones, very difficult to break down, quite a common type of stone. Uric acid, common with patients who have a very low pH. So when you do a urinalysis, you'll see they've got quite a low pH, associated also with a history of gout. Cysteine, calcium phosphate, pretty rare. We're starting to get into the remit of things that would normally go to a specialist for assessment rather than being involved in a sort of day-to-day basis. But again, cysteine stones, very, very hard type of stone that you have to deal with. The struvite stone, magnesium, ammonium, phosphate, we typically see in stag horns.
Oh, you gave away the answer to the next question.
Oh, no.
It's okay, we'll give them one. Okay. Carry on.
So in entering, what type of stone is forms a stag horn? It's basically a magnesium, ammonium, triphosphate stone.
Mm.
So yes, the most common ultimately though is a calcium oxalate. About 70 to 80% of patients will have that type of stone.
What would be, as we've touched on stag horns, what would be your definition of a stag horn stone? Is it that type of stone you've mentioned, or actually some of the characteristics about it?
Well, its characteristics is it goes across two calyces within a kidney. So as long as it goes across two calyces branching away, then you tend to find you've got a stag horn. Obviously, quite often though, we tend to find that they branch into multiple calyces and are particularly sizable to deal with.
Yep. And I guess there's some other things that just popped to my mind. Maybe we'll come on to them later with the investigations and things, but things like the house filled units and then what you see on operation and stuff, there's other certain characteristics, what they look like.
Yeah, so location and size are obviously two other factors. And as you've mentioned about the imaging, particularly with CT, will look at Hounsfield units to give us an idea about how dense those stones are and also then obviously how tough they're going to be. And we can use Hounsfield units as part of our planning for the particular management as to what we would then do for the patient.
We won't give away any more answers.
No.
Yeah, will we?
No.
Okay, so we talked about the different types of stones that we can get, but why do these stones actually occur within patients' urinary tracts? Go.
So essentially with stones formation, there are different theories, but generally speaking, it's been accepted that there are certain factors that allow supersaturation of urine to occur. So with all of the solutes contained within the urine that's been filtered through, if there's just too much of them, they'll eventually crystallize together, and if they go beyond a certain point, that point that we call the solubility product, then essentially they will start to crystallize, and eventually those crystals clump together to form stones. So these are really the factors involved in forming stones. what causes these individual stones to then crystallize and form comes down to a variety of different factors. Those risk factors are if you don't produce much urine in the first place, a low urine pH, if you don't have as much citrate within your urine or magnesium or glycoaminoglycans, or if you have the opposite, an increased amount of uric acid, increased amounts of oxalate and calcium. These are all things that will add to stone formation. Some of these are stone preventing substances, so there are other proteins contained within the urinary tract to try and prevent kidney stones from forming. And if these are particularly deficient in patients, for various theories as to why they're deficient, be it genetic, be it their diet and lifestyle, then you tend to find that these patients will form kidney stones. Unfortunately, like everything in life, one size does not fit all. It's multifactorial, and there's lots of different aspects to consider with kidney stone formation.
And we're going to touch on this a little bit at the end in terms of how individuals can prevent, but it sort of makes me think that there are, as with most things, there are modifiable and non-modifiable risk factors or things about patients that can change their risk of developing. Because there's some patients that are super high risk of always developing whatever you really do, sort of metabolic abnormalities and that sort of thing. So we're going to move quickly on to the more clinical side of things. So you are the urology registrar on call. It's a great life. And you referred a 39-year-old male who's presented to his GP with some right flank pain, and he's got blood on his dipstick. The GP's rang you, wants him to come to SAU. So you accept the patient, comes to SAU. Your SHO is busy, so you're the first person to see them. What should we be asking in our history? And in a focus, maybe should be thinking a little bit more broad if we're the first people to see them, but what should we be asking in our history?
So I guess the first thing to do is you need to actually get the patient to sit down, because quite often they're in a lot of agony. They're pacing around the cubicle, and you almost have to sort of adjust your mindset a little bit and think, well, have they had any analgesia? So once you do get them settled, I suppose the good starting point is really their pain. How long it's been going on for, when it started, have they ever had it before? Are they able to get comfortable with this type of pain? Naturally, this being a urinary tract stone talk, we're talking about urinary tract stones, but you've also got to start thinking about alternative differentials, factors such as infections, non-urological types of pain. So it's important to keep an open mind, but generally speaking, if a patient can't get comfortable with the pain and they're constantly writhing around and they've got pain and tenderness, particularly in their flanks, then you know that you're probably dealing with renal colic. Moving beyond, obviously, the initial sort of pain assessment, it's important to ask about their urinary tract infection history. Have they had a recent infection? If so, what have they been treated with? Have they ever had been told, they've got this particular bug? And this is obviously going to be part of your investigations later when you look up the patient's previous history. Hematuria is important. It's important to know whether they've been passing blood. If so, how long has it been going on for? Because you can have additional pathologies present there. Obviously, if they've got a previous history of kidney stone disease, how long ago did that occur? What was the treatment at the time, and were they told any additional information? And then really your mindset has to start thinking about some of the risk factors, which we'll come on and touch on later. And you start thinking about risk factors for kidney stone formation. Do they have any anatomical abnormalities that might lead them to form a kidney stone? Have they been given any prior diagnosis of chronic kidney disease or renal failure that might then precipitate or contribute to the development of urinary tract stones? And of course, do they have any other additional diagnoses? Have they been told you've only got the one kidney, for example? These are important things to know when you're assessing patients and they come through the door.
This might be, I'm nervous about asking questions in this, that I'm going to, as a urology rash, I'm going to sound like an idiot. But in terms of patients with renal, pre-existing renal disease, is the reason they're more at risk of developing stones because they produce less urine? Is that it? Or,
possibly, or but also because of the scarring of the, there's a lot of theories again behind it, but there is now increasing evidence that chronic kidney disease is increase your risk of developing urinary tract stones now. And there's a lot of evidence, emerging evidence behind it, to suggest that actually we do need to look at these kidneys in closer detail to know what is it about them that means that they're developing more kidney stones.
Yes, their filtration is going to be different and everything in terms of...
Yeah. I mean, if you go back to the basic thing, decrease urine volume.
Yeah.
They're not going, if you've got chronically scarred kidneys, you are not going to be able to produce the sorts of proteins that you need to prevent kidney stone formation. So it seems logical, it's just the question of, well, what do you do about it?
So we've seen our patient, we've taken history, we are fairly confident, like the GP was, this is a kidney stone. But obviously, next step is we're going to examine the patient. So what, if anything, might we find on examination, or how should we conduct our examination?
So, with examination, essentially it's loin tenderness, particularly pain within the renal angles that they might experience. They may have suprapubic tenderness if they've got an associated infection. Naturally, observations of pyrexia, tachycardia, tachypnea are important to realise and assess when you see the patient. But by and large, with examination, it's fairly obvious what you're dealing with, and investigations are probably more relevant in this scenario at this setting.
But it's also simple stuff, especially for an examination answer like what you've mentioned. You can say this patient looks uncomfortable, you know, that general inspection from the end of the bed there. They're walking around, can't get comfy with the pain. So, as we've mentioned, investigation is extremely important. So, what should I be looking at first? Straight away, or ordering for this patient?
So the first thing any SAU should be providing you would be a urinalysis, either from the A&E department or in the department itself. Urinalysis has to be the first port of call. You need to know about the nitrite status, your infections, any leukocytes, and the presence of blood. Blood is not always present with renal colic, but in about 80% of patients you do tend to see blood associated with renal colic. So urinalysis is an important starting point. So I think obviously the next thing is bloods. Full blood count, U's and E's are important. Current guidelines recommend that all patients with suspected kidney stones should have a serum calcium and serum urate level checked as well. When it comes to the door, if you're worried about an infection, I'd add a CRP into that, and also potentially a coagulation screen as well, which I think is an important thing to do, particularly if you're already bleeding the patient. And then really, the most important bit is the investigation of choice in terms of imaging, which should really be a CT-KUB. That is now the established gold standard. We used to use intravenous urograms. I think very few centres now use intravenous urograms. The majority of centres offer a CT-KUB, usually within 24 hours of presentation. The one thing I would add to the CT-KUB is to check what the scalp film looks like, because if you can see a kidney stone on the scalp film, it means that you can follow that patient up with an X-ray KUB, exposing them to less radiation when you're following them up. If you don't see it very obviously, then you know, naturally you would consider whether an X-ray KUB would offer additional evidence to back up your further follow-up.
And just on that note of X-ray exposure, you can do low dose, yes. Very low dose CTKBs. So obviously a lot of these patients are young patients. Not unfrequently get patients in their 20s presented with this kind of presentation, or 30s. So sort of it's just something to consider that actually they are. You can get very low dose CTKBs.
You can get very low dose CTKBs, and they are okay at looking for things like kidney stone disease. Again, you have to check with your local department what you can offer. But generally speaking, it's accepted now that CTKBs, most modern CT scanners, offer you radiation exposure, which isn't that troublesome. And if you think about a transatlantic flight, CT abdo pelvis with contrast is the same amount of radiation as a transatlantic flight.
There you go, one CT a year, one holiday a year. Yeah?
Exactly.
Okay, so I think in that as well, I guess we mentioned a bit earlier looking at their past investigation, so it's sort of important at that point to remember to look at previous MSUs that we talked about, if they're known to have, okay, here's an extra question, what bug would you, if you saw a bug on a previous MSU that made you think of stones, what would that be? Set that question mark.
Yeah, so I mean there's three bugs that spring to mind. Proteus, Pseudomonas and Klebsiella. Mm-hmm. You can also get urea plasma urealyticum, which is associated with magnesium ammonium triphosphate stones or struvite stones. So those are probably the ones that I would look for.
Yeah. Okay, so again, quick question. Where are the most common places, that ureteric stones get stuck? Go.
So, usually at the pelvo-ureteric junction, the pelvic brim, and the vesico-ureteric junction.
Right. Okay, so you know all this about the patient. Patient's got a stone. What factors are affecting your decision as to whether this patient needs to be admitted or not?
So essentially, I ask myself when I see a patient about three things: the pain, the risk of infection, and the risk of obstruction. And I'm looking at their clinical history examination and their investigations to try and answer that question.
Mm-hmm.
I think if a patient is particularly uncomfortable with pain, the pain's not settling with initial first-line treatment, it's a bit unfair to send them home. They're going to need to come in for increased analgesia. But what's probably more of a concern for me is things like infection and obstruction. If that kidney is blocked, if there's any risk of an infection, then this is a patient that is probably going to look unwell from the end of the bed. They're probably going to need to be in, they're going to need to have intervention. And these are the patients who I'd look at and say, I'm going to admit you.
Mm-hmm.
I think the other group of patients you have to look at are those that are typically in your high risk categories, those patients who've got previous comorbidities, things like chronic kidney disease, where their renal function is already pretty poor to start off with, patients who've got multiple comorbidities, and perhaps are more susceptible and have a lower physiological reserve when fighting against nasty infections. Those are the sorts of patients that I would identify and say, you're going to stay in.
Mm. I remember at my last hospital, not to compare it to York at all, but had a very good renal colic pathway. And part of that, it was managed by the AMPs, but part of that was a lot of those criteria you just mentioned, if they don't hit them, then they could go home. And it was things like, you know, like the presence of rigors, so thinking about infection, and then, you know, a certain cough for their CRP, a certain cough for white cells, any urological, complicated urological background, so is there, and then sort of AKI and that sort of thing. And then if they hit any of them, they'll speak to you, so you have to then have an answer.
Yeah.
Okay, so this patient, you're going to admit them. So the patient is febrile and is showing signs of sepsis, they've got raised inflammatory markers. We might have kind of already suggested it, but what do you need to think about? Let's imagine, oh, I've got written here, what would investigation would you do? But we've kind of already done our CT, haven't we? So, but what do we actually just need to be thinking about? What words do we need to say in the exam in answer to this question?
It's simple. Infected obstructed kidney. That's the most important take-home thing.
Yeah.
And if you know you take anything away from this, that's the number one thing you've got to look for if you see a patient who's either in the A&E department or an SAU. If they look unwell, these are the sorts of patients who will become unwell very, very quickly. And we're talking a matter of hours. So as soon as you suspect an infected obstructed kidney, we need to start thinking about the urgent investigations as above. I would probably throw into that a blood gas as part of it. I would stress the coagulation and blood cultures, and I would stress doing a coagulation screen because these patients may well need to have intervention being done. The most important thing when you recognise an infected obstructed kidney is
sepsis? Six?
No.
Do something about it.
Yeah.
Threw you off,
did I? I was just sort of staring into the room. Yeah.
Urgent decompression.
Yeah, there we go. Yeah. Do something about it. But if to my point stands, they do still need that initial treatment, don't they? That A, B, C, D, E.
Yeah, they do.
They need their antibiotics, they need their resuscitation.
Yeah. And the one thing I would stress that a lot of people forget is that we'll come on to nephrostomies and so on, but cultures are very, very important because you need to know what you're dealing with. If you've got a septic patient, a blood culture is vital, as well as a urine culture. You need to know what's going on with those patients.
Yeah.
So as I say, urgent decompression is important, and you either do it with a nephrostomy or ureteric stenting. Now, there is no evidence to suggest that one is more superior over the other. However, different departments have access to different facilities. Some may have a very well-supportive interventional radiology department. Getting a nephrostomy in late at night is not a problem. Great. But other departments may find that they don't have that support, and so you may therefore be relying on ureteric stenting to try and decompress these kidneys.
So you don't, in terms of if you've got a septic patient, a lot of people will say put a nephrostomy in because it's you don't have to have a GA, that sort of thing. You agree with that? Or?
So in our local practices, to put a nephrostomy into those patients, and that's fine. And there was one RCT that tried to look into the differences between nephrostomy and stenting. And found no difference. And I worked in departments in the past where we would do ureteric stenting as registrars, as first line, because we were just struggling to get hold of access to get a kidney unblocked just through nephrostomy. Mm. So in those sorts of situations, it's a perfectly reasonable option.
Yeah. They've got a very good nephrostomy service here.
Absolutely.
Okay, so I mean, we've basically touched on the answer to this, but just to talk a little bit about what your CT report might say, if you're reading it, and to suggest it will probably say an obstructed system on the report, hopefully, but you know, so they'll have maybe a 8, 9, 10 millimetre obstructing stone, ureteric stone, there'll probably be hydronephrosis of some degree, there'll probably be some perinephric, periureteric stranding, some dilatation of the kidney, that's the kind of thing that you'll hear, you'll read on the report. That's correct. Would you agree? Yeah.
Yes.
Nodding. Okay, so that's acute. You know, you're an infected, obstructed, sick patient. Very, very important to recognise and to do things quickly about. Just to note as well that these patients, you know, even once you've got their nephrostomy and all their stent in, they can still deteriorate really quickly. I've had patients that have gone to ICU an hour after having a stent because they've had septic shower. So they are patients that really need to stay on your radar even after you have done the intervention that they need, and obviously they need ongoing antibiotics, etc. So this time we've got a patient who's also had a CT, that they've got a, we're going to go with a 5mm left midurateric stone. He's got normal bloods. His pain's been controlled with PR diclofenac with a bit of paracetamol. He's okay. What are your treatment options then?
So the treatment options essentially would either be conservative or actively intervene with the patient. Conservative management is usually the mainstay for a patient who's got a 5mm stone. There has been some conflicting evidence about medical expulsive therapy. So what medical expulsive therapy is the use of an additional medication to try and help facilitate the stone being passed through. Different things have been tried, and there have been different studies on it, but generally speaking, tamsulosin, which is an alpha-1A alpha blocker, will effectively be the one that most people will know about and will utilize in our A&E departments. But generally speaking, the evidence these days points to saying that if it's in the lower third of the ureter and it's greater than about 6mm in size, then it's okay to use it. Otherwise, it generally doesn't make a difference for anything in any other location or size. If you're talking about a mid-ureteric stone, I generally offer the patient a period of conservative management. Lots of fluids, analgesia, give it a couple of weeks and see how it passes. There's no clear consensus about how long you leave it for, but most departments generally are looking at between 2 and 4 weeks. And if the stone hasn't passed at that point, then you're looking to actively intervene. An active intervention in these situations would either be a rigid ureteroscopy to try and go and fish out the stone or use a laser to break the stone up. Some centres, depending on location and availability, might offer a shockwave treatment. Shockwave lithotripsy is a treatment, but again, it depends on location, size and comorbidities for the patient, because not all patients can have shockwave lithotripsy.
So that's going back to sort of what we mentioned at the beginning as well, isn't it, in terms of, because composition, position of the stone, all that kind of thing affects the likelihood of them being having successful ESWL.
Yeah.
And one thing to note with that is, I get some patients have to have 2 episodes, don't they? So when you're counselling patients about those 2 options, which quite often they can both be quite viable solutions, that's one thing to consider. Obviously, a URS needs a GA and that kind of thing as well.
Yeah. And it's also about access to your local facilities and how easy it is to get these things done.
Yeah, yeah. Waiting list. ESWL would happen quicker here, right?
It would, yeah. But you know, it depends. You know, some departments are very lucky and have an on-site lithotripter, and quite, you know, a few departments I know of will take their patients straight down to the lithotripter as soon as they come in. Other departments don't have access to that. There is a long wait for them. You have to look at what your local options are, and also what's important for the patient, isn't it?
Yeah. Okay, well, what are the treatment for ureteric stones? We've talked about that, haven't we? Important to, I guess, in that mention, just if we've sort of talked about renal stones or stag-borne stones, so PCNL is obviously for bigger, complex stones, that's another treatment option for patients. So how do we follow up patients, and I'm going to go with, would we follow up patients, and how would we follow up, and is that dependent on different types of patients?
Yeah, so we would follow up patients depending on their risk categories. So the European Association of Urology has published guidelines which have talked about low risk and high risk categories. Essentially, low risk is if you've presented for the first time, you've got a single stone and no other sort of comorbidities or risk factors, then you're a low risk type of a scenario.
That's fine, carry on.
If, however, you do have a whole series of, you know, any of these particular risk factors, then you are ultimately looking at being in the high risk category, and I have a different protocol for managing those patients as opposed to the low risk patients. EAU has classified 39 potential high risk factors. So it's a very long list. You don't need to learn all of them for the exam. However, for your listeners don't need to know it. However, Naomi, you
do. Don't right now, so don't ask me.
But also they further classified patients who've got CKD and end-stage renal failure and kidney stone disease of patients who you need to look out for, as well as patients who've got CKD and just on its own with kidney stone disease, and also patients who've got metabolic bone disease. You need to look at those sorts of patients, and they have an increased risk. So there's lots of subcategories of patients from a risk factor point of view. Essentially, this is all the remit of someone who would then come to a urologist who specialises in this area. And we're very lucky at York to have links with a clinical biochemist who has an interest in kidney stone disease, as well as our own renal department that have interest in trying to prevent kidney stones. And it then goes into the remit of metabolic stone disease and trying to prevent that cohort of patients from coming back repeatedly with kidney stones. So essentially, in terms of how we follow up our patients, we generally give them advice on diet and fluids. We give them a dedicated leaflet on diet, which lists the types of stones that they can form, as well as some of the potential dietary interventions. The number one thing that we tell all of our patients is they need to drink more. They just simply need to dilute urine. And that's the one thing that has been through, has a high level of evidence to back up the idea that you need to be drinking a lot of water. And people are trying to put figures on it. People have quoted 2.5 litres, some have said 3 litres. Generally, in my experience, I've found that if you just tell a patient, have a look at your wee, if it's anything darker than pale yellow, you're not drinking enough. And you tell them they need to go away and drink a bit more. And generally, patients respond when you tell them that. But diet, again, is another factor, and particularly oxalate. Oxalate is quite a common type of kidney stone. Oxalate is something that as humans we can't process, but it's contained within a variety of foodstuffs, anything from red meat to beetroot, spinach, certain types of nuts, tea. So oxalate is something that we ingest, we can't process, it has to be filtered through. If you don't dilute your urine and you've got it accumulating, then unfortunately you've got calcium oxalate stones.
So you'd say fluid is first, because if your urine is dilute enough, then however much oxalate you have.
If you go back to the solubility product,
yeah.
You know, if you are able to dilute and spread those solutes out, you're not going to form any crystals in kidney stones. So it's the most logical thing you can explain to patients as a first-line treatment.
So if you're going to go for an all-you-can-eat meat dinner, just drink 4 litres of water as well.
Yeah, exactly. 4 litres of water. But you've also got to appreciate that the patient who turns up and they only drink barely half a litre, if you turn around and say drink 2.5 litres, they're never going to do it.
Yeah.
That's the purpose of sort of saying to them, well, you know, you need to build up a little bit, and every patient's different, and we're very lucky to have a stone nurse specialist who's working with some of our patients to help improve their diet.
Yeah. I've done things like, if you talk to them specifically about bottles, so rather than just saying, you know, drink 3 litres, say maybe go and get yourself a nice new bottle, and then you know how much that is, and then just drink 2 of them, 3 of them a day. And I think people find that a bit more easy than just saying drink 3 litres.
Yeah.
I definitely don't drink 3 litres of water. So I think, yeah, that's what we sort of wanted to add on the end there, that sort of touching on the risk factors, really, so sort of eating, you know, meat, fluid, salt as well as the other one, isn't it, to reduce salt intake.
I think, like everything, it's just trying to have a balanced diet, isn't it?
Yeah. Drink lots of lemonade.
The citrate is actually quite important, because citrate's been proven to reduce the risk of kidney stone formation. So we do sometimes say squeeze a bit of lemon. Into some water, and, you know, I've told patients in the past, have a bit of hot water with a squeeze of lemon in it.
Yeah. Great. Anything else you think is important to touch on?
I think, no, for the exam, really, with kidney stones, the most important things to stress is obviously how the patients present with kidney stones, identifying those patients who are in particularly large amounts of pain, infection or obstruction. Mm-hmm. I know that there will be questions about certain types of kidney stones. That's obviously something that's important to remember, and also, you know, have a little bit of knowledge about when kidney stones form, you know, how they form, why they form, and really those are things that are important not just for the exam but for day-to-day practice. Mm. As a surgical trainee, if you're in A&E, these are the sorts of things that patients will want the answers to, and yeah, these are the bits of things you should just know about.
Yeah. Well, great. Thank you so much. I think that was really good. I hope you enjoyed it. Yes. You're a natural. but thank you very much for listening, everyone. I hope you found that helpful, and we will be back shortly with another episode. Great. Take care. Bye-bye. Oh, well, a dim-bone, 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 dim-bone.